Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Jay Mackey. I'm here on behalf of Roman Shinaki. Here with me is Cullen Sweeney from the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office, who served as amicus in this case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
On March 23rd of this year, following oral argument on a limited procedural question in this case, the court ordered supplemental briefing on two questions. First, whether sex offender reclassification challenge hearings conducted to Senate Bill 10 are criminal or civil proceedings. And second, whether sex offenders are entitled to the appointment of counsel for those hearings if they are civil in nature. SB 10 reclassification challenge hearings are sui generis, and they defy traditional notions of civil and criminal. This court should remain mindful that at such hearings, the state is represented by the county prosecutor, pursuant to the statute. And because future classifications are part of the sentencing process, those who are classified in the future will be represented by counsel at their sentencing hearings. Furthermore, all of the offenders who have been reclassified were represented by counsel at their initial House Bill 180 hearings. As a result, the only group of people who are not represented by counsel involved in sex offender classification are those who are being reclassified administratively by the Attorney General.
Well, Mr. Mackey, if you're saying that, if I heard you correctly, this is in a sense a part of the sentence, the classification is a part of the sentence, it's part of the journal entry for sentencing, is that correct?
Going forward, the statute requires that Tier 3 offenders specifically be notified.
But didn't that also happen previously when judges would sentence somebody, the classification, the risk assessment, all was part of the criminal proceeding, the sentencing?
It was actually done in a separate journal entry prior to the sentencing.
Okay,
but yes, it was all incorporated.
Okay, and could you not analogize this to a modification of a sentence? If you say that the classification itself is part of the sanction that's imposed on the person solely because of the conviction of this type of offense.
I think you absolutely could, Justice Lansinger, and we suggest that if it is a modification of a sentence, then this is a crucial stage of the criminal proceedings and the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches. Now, I understand that not all of the members of the court or not all of the court at all may agree with the idea that this is a modification of the sentence. But certainly, given our normal posture and the posture that that House Bill 180 hearings had, and that the fact that the prior classification was included during that sentencing period, this may well be a modification of the sentence.
When we look at whether a new statute is civil or criminal, the idea of what the legislature intends is certainly the first step, and we know that from all the discussions so far, this is determined to be civil, at least from what the General Assembly has intended. But don't we go into the secondary question of the intent, or rather the effect upon the offender? And would you say that the Martinez-Menendez seven criteria must be used in that case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Kennedy factors, the seven Kennedy criteria would occur. I would suggest also that given the nature of what this court has heard so far in the Bodike oral argument, that the General Assembly's pronouncement that this is intended to be a civil remedial measure has a little less weight than it might have if this were enacted originally. It's worth noting that Ohio is the only state in the Union that has gone from a risk-based classification scheme to an offense-based classification scheme. It's not simply going from one offense-based classification scheme to another. All of the various different arguments that Mr. Gamzo raised earlier might not arise under that circumstance. In this
Counsel,
case,
let me understand that. There's other states that have an offense-based registration system in place as their initial attempt at this. And if they go forward to, I guess, comport with what the federal requirements are, that wouldn't be the same situation that we have here.
Well, certainly the separation of powers issue might not be a problem. The retroactive laws provision as it's laid out in the Ohio Constitution might not be a problem. The other thing to note is that the United States Supreme Court in Smith v. Doe did indicate that there's no federal ex post facto problem with purely offense-based classification schemes.
So the problem that we are presented with is because the statute initially in Senate Bill 5 and 180 had a risk assessment attached to the classification.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's the real problem here.
So it's going from transitioning from one basis for the classification to another.
Certainly there's an additional problem that could arise under the state constitution related to the onerous nature of the new requirements.
And let me just ask one more question. If we continue to regard the registration requirement as civil, and I know that your initial argument that it's sui generis and it's neither fish nor fowl. It could be one or the other, or a hybrid. But say we follow Cook and Ferguson, and it's determined to continue to be a civil statute. How does that enter into your position with respect to the, is this part of a criminal sentencing, and is this a sentencing modification, which was previously asked?
I would submit that there would remain a due process, a fundamental due process right to counsel, at least for reclassification hearings, that the Kennedy factors, the seven Kennedy factors that this court would use to determine whether this is a penal punitive statute, even if this court were to determine, based upon those seven Kennedy factors, that this were not a penal punitive statute, it is so close to the line that it, under the Matthews versus Eldridge analysis, those seven Kennedy factors would inform the first prong in the Matthews versus Eldridge analysis. And it is so close to the line. It has such fundamental lifelong consequences for the individuals involved that there should still be a right to counsel at reclassification challenge.
Does that make it quasi-criminal then? Is that what you're urging upon the court?
Certainly, Your Honor, if you were to hold that it is not criminal in toto, it is definitely quasi-criminal, yes.
Counsel, if you have a prospective application, you have a trial, and the judge says, okay, Adam Walsh requires you to be put in this category, they have counsel at that point, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So you have a group, prospectively, they're going to have counsel for these reclassifications every time they're classified, and then you have a group with no counsel being automatically reclassified, and the debate before us is whether, if they ask for this hearing, they get counsel.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And is the Attorney General correct? Is it your experience that the only challenge that they are claiming you can make is whether you're actually put in the right category?
Well, it actually, that's the Attorney General's position. There are 88 county prosecutors who have various different opinions on the matter, and since the county prosecutor is the one who represents the interest of the state at those hearings, it changes from county to county. Several county prosecutors filed a civil rule failure to state a claim motions, and there were counties where those petitions were dismissed outright. There were counties that were dismissed on the pleadings based upon intervening appellate court decisions. There were counties where the simple problem is that the offender or registrant who was challenging the classification couldn't even get in the door because they hadn't captioned their pleading correctly according to what the individual county clerk wanted. So without the benefit of counsel in relation to these proceedings, it was simply extremely difficult for counties or for individuals to ensure that their rights were protected. And the amicus brief filed in this case by county public defenders who did choose to represent individuals noted that so many of these cases, and there were a number of judgment entries attached to that brief, where there had been misclassifications. So even if that were the only thing at issue in this case, as the Attorney General had contended in their briefs, we submit that the right of counsel is still required to help these folks navigate through this really complex process.
That's your due process argument, right, which I'd like to hear your the Lassiter, Vitek, and mm-hmm. and Eldridge cases that seem to support your position.
Is that
enough for you, for me to just to say that? Or do you
it may well be, Your Honor.
I'm just throwing it out as a question.
I appreciate that. Again, I think that those cases demonstrate that while there is a presumption against appointed counsel in cases where someone's personal liberty there is not at stake. That presumption can be overcome, and we submit that it is overcome in this case with reference to cases, and that this is the Lassiter analysis, with reference to the three Matthews versus Eldridge factors, and specifically with reference to the Kennedy seven-factor test to determine whether a statute is penal.
The third test under Eldridge, the risk that the procedures used will lead to erroneous decisions. I think someplace I read 19% of these reclassifications were in error by the Attorney General's office.
It is a shockingly huge number.
It's a fairly substantial error rate for somebody who doesn't have counsel to try to. It's a great number of people, I guess, who have a, if they have a personal interest in this, that to overcome and to work their way through what to us doesn't seem like a terribly complicated process, but for someone without counsel, it could be rather daunting, it seems to me.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor. It is one of those situations, again, where they may not even be able to locate the portion of 2950.01 that demonstrates what tier that they are to fall into to correctly challenge this. It's an extremely difficult process.
Would such a proceeding be limited to the tier classification, or do you see issues beyond the tier classification that might be the subject of such a hearing?
There are a number of other issues, and the way the statute reads is what it, specifically the statute reads that the issues to be addressed at that hearing are what tier the person should fall into or whether the person should be classified at all. There are a number of different ways to interpret that particular language. The Attorney General and most of the prosecutors around the state have interpreted in the narrowest fashion, just as the ministerial action of the judge of approving the Attorney General's tier classification. We think that there are a number of other issues that can be raised.
What other issues do you?
Well, certainly all of the constitutional issues that were raised in the cases you just heard. Once those issues are resolved by this court, there will be other issues relating to out-of-state offenders as to what is the proper tier that they should be placed in, whether or not community notification should follow along, and that's a huge issue. In 2950.11, the statute provides for the opportunity for relief of community notification if you were not subject to community notification under the prior law. And it then lists a number of factors which are analogous to those factors under the prior law to determine what your classification was. So presumably the court would be able to take expert testimony in and examine the same kinds of evidence that it had originally under a House Bill 180 hearing at that scenario.
I have a practical question. Under the reclassification, when was it completed, roughly?
When was the reclassification completed?
Yes.
I believe it was completed prior to the sentencing.
No. The ones that the Attorney General's done.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Maybe I misunderstood. The reclassification that the Attorney General did, that was done late in the year of 2007.
And then they had 60 days from that date to challenge.
However, there was some intervening federal litigation that placed a stay.
Okay, that's going to be my question. If we grant the right to counsel, does it mean anything if you're past your 60 days? So where do we stand on that issue?
Right now, that federal litigation has been dismissed. That stay has been lifted. I would submit to a court that there's really no expiration on procedural due process rights, and that the state's intent or the state's attempt to put a 60-day window on that and put the onus on an individual who has many obstacles to filing a challenge simply does not comport with procedural due process.
Although if we find that this is impermissibly retroactive, does that evaporate?
If the law is impermissibly retroactive, or if it violates separation of powers, or if you accept any of the arguments that were put forth in the Bodike case, most of these problems will disappear.
Because generally speaking, there's already an attorney for purposes of sentencing and all the ramifications of classification going forward would not be affected.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see
counsel,
my time is about to.
Another question. If we do find that it's permissible or that the appointment of an attorney is necessary for this reclassification portion, What does that do to the argument about – does that dilute the argument of separation of powers that we have been hearing?
I don't believe that it does dilute the separation of powers argument. The separation of powers violation would be complete at the time the Attorney General issues its reclassification and the person is forced to comply with it.
Even though there is the component of the opportunity – or there's the opportunity, which is a component of the statute for judicial intervention, oversight with – if we state that the representation by counsel is mandatory.
The judicial intervention that the statute contemplates on its terms does not allow a judge to relieve the person from the current reclassification. They can change the classification, the tier classification that they are in, according to the actual offense. But they are not allowed to say, you know what, or at least arguably not allowed to say, you know what, you should be classified as your old classification, a sexually oriented offender.
Well, that's because it no longer exists. There's a new scheme, but, you know, if there's a correction method.
Yes, Your Honor, but I mean, it's important to note, 77% of the offenders under the prior scheme were classified as sexually oriented offenders. That number has dropped to 13% of Tier 1 offenders. 54% of the offenders are now in the highest tier. Ms. Radigan pointed out earlier, this dilutes the effectiveness of the registration scheme entirely, but it also has significant deprivation and causes significant hardship on those who have been reclassified into that high tier. And I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Mackey. Mr. Lieberman.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Let me start with Justice Stratton's question is, if this Court were to find that there was a due process right to counsel in these hearings, but a pro se individual missed their deadline or didn't file the right paperwork, the Attorney General would believe that if there is a constitutional right, then all the hearings, they would have a right to come back with counsel and start over in a new reclassification challenge. Now, turning to the overriding threshold question in this case, which is similar to in the Bodike case, whether or not this is a civil or criminal law under the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors. There's been a lot of discussion this morning about the General Assembly's changeover to automatic offense-based classification systems. And as Mr. Mackey mentioned, the Supreme Court in Smith v. Doe in 2003 said that was okay. Let me explain why there was a switchover, both Congress's reasons and the General Assembly's reasons. In 2006, there were 50 different state sex offender registration systems. There were many different standards. There were many different definitions of offenses, and everybody was using different procedures. So in 2006, there were 500,000 registered sex offenders across the country. Because the states were all using different systems, the states lost track of 100,000 of them because individuals move across state lines. They set up new residences. And so the move to the offense-based system was a desire for uniformity, that when an individual decides that he wants to establish residence in a new state, that the new state, he comes into the new state and he knows what his tier obligations are, and that the state is able to keep track of them, him. That is plainly both a civil intent to go that way, and it is a civil effect because it improves the efficacy of all the state systems. Everybody is using one standard. And after we move past the changeover to the automatic offense-based classification, much of Senate Bill 10 operates very similarly to the Megan's Law that this Court reviewed in Cook, but also in Ferguson. The community notification provisions operate in the exact same fashion, and further that when an offender moves into a particular neighborhood, the county sheriff sends out a postcard notification containing the name, the photograph, the tier level, the crime of conviction.
Counsel, I understand the need for uniformity and the mobility of society, et cetera. What I'm struggling with is how someone in the lowest requirement category under the previous law can be bumped in up to the highest category. And what is the rationale? If we're going to look at the rationale for the legislation and use that as a justification for this, which I understand, again, the need for uniformity, I don't understand the need to take the least offensive offenders and characterize them with the most egregious offenders. There will be crossover. The most egregious ones in the previous classification will still be in the highly monitored most egregious category. But I guess what I'm troubled with is the inclusion of the least offensive members into, if the statistics are correct, as opposing counsel just mentioned, how is that a permissible use?
Your Honor, it is because the old system, the Attorney General would dispute that there was a judicial finding as that there were for somebody with a sexually orientated offender designation, that was the default category. If the state prosecutor, for whatever reason, did not seek the higher category, that is what the individual came up with. So it was not an individualized determination that this person was the lowest dangerous offender.
So are you saying the prosecutors didn't review these cases sufficiently to determine the category, and now this reclassification is going to do a better job of it, even though there's no evidence before the Attorney General or the legislature that any of these people were not correctly addressed by the court?
Not at all. I'm saying that individual prosecutors made certain choices in individual cases, be as the Huron County prosecutor mentioned, resource constraints, time constraints. The point is that was the default group. The General Assembly and the Congress did change the classification system, but there we know from Smith versus Doe that there is nothing wrong with making categorical judgments about an offender's past dangerousness.
And that's, you say, is support for taking it from a risk-based analysis to a classification, I mean, an offense-based classification.
Together with the need for uniformity across all 50 states.
Is that what the case states, though? You can shift from a scrutinized tier system to, or a scrutinized system individual to what we have now.
No, there was not a changeover in Smith versus Doe.
It's just a general statement that you can use offense-based criteria for classification.
That's correct, Your Honor, but if the General Assembly could have enacted Senate Bill 10 in 1997, and they did Megan's Law instead.
If they started out with this system, yep. You're saying we wouldn't be here.
Correct.
But we've got what we've got, which is a shift from risk-based to this just blanket classification.
But if the General Assembly had the authority to enact Senate Bill 10 originally, it should have the authority to change over. That is something that is within the legislative.
Prospectively, we may agree with you. The question is retroactivity.
Well, we look at those provisions of the law that operate retroactively. And I would again refer back to Cook. Like a number of these offenders, yes, they jumped up in their registration requirements from annual registration for 10 years to quarterly registration for life. That was the exact same change in Cook among a large number of offenders who were classified under the really old scheme and then were reclassified into the Megan's Law scheme.
But wasn't that still a risk-based to risk-based judicial analysis?
I believe the old system was automatic offense-based, and then if you went from annual registration for 10 years to 20 years as a habitual offender under Cook, I think that would have been automatic. Of course, if you went up to the sexual predator designation, that would require an individualized determination. But I would refer back to my original point that there's nothing wrong with categorical judgments about an offender's future dangerousness.
Counsel, I want to back up to perhaps an overarching historical, philosophical.
Yes, Your Honor.
Look at this. You keep, and it's your job, you're the Assistant Attorney General, you want to look at this through the eyes of the government. Did the government have a good reason at the congressional level? Were they trying to achieve something that's reasonable and all of that? Our whole Bill of Rights is really designed to protect us from the government. If you look at it and tick them off one at a time. And you seem to be reluctant to ever consider what our job is to not only balance the government's interests, but to consider through the eyes of the defendant or offender, however obnoxious their offense might have been, what that Bill of Rights means in toto to protect them from the government. And that isn't that really the problem here that we have to address in terms of retroactive application?
Your Honor, I completely understand that the individuals raising these challenges are upset about their reclassification, that they do not wish to register with greater frequency, and that they believe that that is a punitive act by the General Assembly. My point is that this was the same argument that was made in Cook. You had a group of individuals that were bumped up to quarterly registration for life, which this court said was a de minimis administrative requirement. It was absolutely something that the individuals did not like. But my
Cook
point
is taking us back a long way, and you've read Ferguson.
Yes.
You saw that the author of Cook and myself, who joined in Cook, joined Justice Lanzinger in her dissent in Ferguson when we were looking at a different scheme and a different issue. And this one is even different yet.
I certainly understand the dissenting position in Ferguson, but the majority of position in Ferguson addressed many of the issues in terms of the actual registration and the community notification that are here before the court today. We heard a lot in this argument and the last argument about license plate information. We collected that license plate information under the Megan's Law version reviewed in Ferguson. We are now requiring the offenders to register with the county sheriff of their home, work, and, if applicable, school. That was the issue in Ferguson, which this court said was not punitive, but was justified with a public safety goal. The community notification, as I mentioned either before in the last argument, is the exact same as what was occurring under the Megan's Law in Ferguson. And indeed, the General Assembly put a safety valve in here for reclassified offenders to say, I don't need community notification. They can petition the trial court to say, please let me out. It's not needed by my individualized facts and circumstances. I've demonstrated no danger. And then the trial court has the complete discretion to get rid of that requirement in Senate Bill 10 for any reclassified offender.
Counsel, the bill that has been passed that said you go from the 52% now go into Tier 3, was that required? Were those categories required to be put in Tier 3 by the federal legislation, or is that a choice made by the General Assembly?
That was required by Congress. The Congress set out the tiers pursuant to its spending clause authority. I messed up the answer in the last argument. And they set out the exact tiers or the exact offenses that fall under each tier. And then the General Assembly took those definitions and put them under the three tiers in Senate Bill 10.
So if the government was really concerned about notification across state lines, they could have still created 1, 2, and 3, and the states could have put their appropriate categories into 1 to match up really what had happened at the trial level, and you still would have had plenty of ability to notify across state lines because you've got the same three categories now.
That's correct, Your Honor, but the problem was that under the prior regime, you had three categories, but everybody defined them differently. And so that was why Congress stepped in with the Adam Walsh Act, and Ohio was the first state, but there are a number of states behind us in line seeking certification right now. We all wanted to move to one system with the uniformity to...
So that our legislature let the federal government determine what our classifications were, essentially.
The General Assembly adopted the classification set by Congress, Your Honor, yes.
Counsel, I have some difficulty believing that the United States Congress could figure out what gross sexual imposition meant in 50 different states and say that should all be category Tier 3 or Tier 2. I just don't believe that. I can't imagine that they fine-tooth-combed the criminal statutes of 50 states and made a decision where each category of sexual offender belonged in their three-tier system.
It's a little bit more complex than that, Your Honor.
I'll bet it was.
Congress set out the types of crimes elements in the law, and then vested the responsibility of working with the individual states to come up with unique state definitions or offense definitions in the Department of Justice, and that's how we get our certification. The General Assembly takes its own laws, taking what Congress has done, and then coordinates our tier classifications with the Federal Adam Walsh Act with help from and assistance from the Justice Department as to they supervise.
Just what you were asked by Justice Stratton, whether or not the Ohio General Assembly exercised some discretion in determining what went where.
Yes, Your Honor.
And they did.
Well, they were following the standards set by federal law.
Mr. Lieberman, the most important question to me is the one I posed to opposing counsel on the due process. That's a separate line of thinking.
Yes, Your Honor.
You know, and I think it really deserves some comment by you, because it seems to me that if we look at Eldridge, that we have something to consider: the private interest at stake, the government's interest, and the risk that the procedures used will lead to erroneous decision. That's assuming that we decide that this whole process is not criminal.
Yes, Your Honor. Let me quickly try to answer your question. The threshold question for a civil right to counsel under the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution is whether the individual faces either a potential deprivation of rights at the proceeding in question, or he is at a loss of a possible termination of a fundamental constitutional right. Mr. Shernacki is not at loss of a potential deprivation of liberty in his reclassification challenge. One of two things will happen in this hearing. Either the trial court will leave him at a Tier 2, or will reduce him to a Tier 1, or will kick out all requirements. But under no circumstances can the trial court order Mr. Shinaki's incarceration.
But we're talking here about right to counsel. That's the issue in this case.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then the threshold question.
The process, it seems to me, is not a very easy process. Let's assume some other brief, I guess, 19% was given us as the error rate. And it's understandable that the Attorney General's office would make that many errors, because it's not easy, I wouldn't think, to do this on a cold sheet of a paper or whatever to decide what category into someone should be placed. And so why shouldn't a person be entitled to counsel when he or she some of their curtailment of liberty is being affected? It's a process that's not easy for It's easy for us, perhaps, not that easy, but it's not a simple process to challenge the Attorney General's classification, is it?
Well, let me first address the misclassification allegations made by opposing counsel, and then I'll move on and give a legal response. The Attorney General disputes the 19% classification rate, and there's no evidence in this record to show that it is nearly that high. The only evidence that we have is the Cuyahoga County Public Defender, in its amicus brief, provided a list of 27 cases where the trial court found that the Attorney General made a reclassification error. That's 27 cases out of 3,600 reclassifications in Cuyahoga County, so that's less than 1%. But turning to my legal point, under the Due Process Clause.
To put that in perspective, what percentage were challenged that resulted in the 27? I think that's a better analysis. Because if you challenge 3,600 and 27 are bad, that's one figure. If you challenge 100 and 27 are bad, that's a whole different figure.
The Cuyahoga County Public Defender said in its amicus brief that it is representing, I think, individuals in 460 cases, and then they have cited just 27 cases where they found a reclassification error. I can't do the math on the top of my head, but I don't believe that's 19%. Returning to my legal point as to under the Federal Due Process Clause to get counsel, the individual still has to show a potential deprivation of liberty or a possible termination of a fundamental right. And the existing case law.
What about the right to privacy?
I believe in State versus Williams, this court said that sex offender registration and notification does not implicate any of the fundamental rights. And the court listed them, and I think privacy was in there. It included the right to procreate, right to travel, right to vote, right to free speech. So
that was under the old, a less burdensome criteria or requirements, correct?
Yes, that was under the old Megan's Law. So if this court could distinguish Williams and say that, presumably say that, that yes, this does implicate a fundamental right. I don't see that from the case law, but obviously it's up to this court.
So you're
to,
saying absent the implication of a fundamental right, the due process is not violated by not assigning an attorney, providing an attorney at the juncture of the reclassification?
It's either the deprivation of a liberty or the facing the potential termination of a fundamental right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court has not ruled that the fundamental rights are implicated either.
I mean,
they've left that question open on the substantive due process, have they not, in State versus Doe, for example?
In Smith versus Doe,
Smith versus Doe.
Yes, Justice Lansing, you are correct. In Smith versus Doe, the United States Supreme Court only addressed the ex post facto, the criminal or civil distinctions under the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors, which relates only to my first argument, not to my
second. Then they
argument.
Had the Connecticut case that was talking about procedural due process, correct? But they left substantive due process alone.
I don't know for sure, but I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
What's the one of the other the second tests, as you know, Eldridge, is the government's interest. Government has an interest, certainly the state government, local government has an interest in protecting people from certainly the highest form of sexual conduct. But what's the government's interest in placing into the highest category a whole number, a vast number of people who judges decided were in the lowest category? We've got law enforcement folks in amicus brief saying that just dilutes the category. It really dilutes the effectiveness of the highest category. What's the government's interest in doing that?
Well, as I said before, the state's position is that there was, with respect to the low category, the sexually oriented offender designation, there was not a judicial determination. It was a classification attached as a matter of law. I won't repeat that. But it was that the fact that the General Assembly may have decided that the previous system was not working as well, or that this was a better system, or that the desire to achieve uniformity and consistency across the state.
I think the statistics, it seems, seem to indicate that the lowest level offenders, the recidivism rate there is pretty low there. Is that not right? So am I correct on that, or do you agree with that? Or?
I do not agree with that. In both cases, or both arguments this morning, both sides have their statistics. And the court dealt with this just last year in Ferguson. Both sides had their statistical claims about sex offender recidivism. And in Ferguson, the court said we're not going to sit here and judge who is the better or more sound statistics. That's up to the General Assembly. But I'll engage on the statistical claims. We dispute the statistical claims about effectiveness of sex offender laws and sex offender recidivism that have been raised in both cases. First, the statistics relied on by the appellants use official arrest and conviction rates, but it is well accepted that arrest and conviction rates for sex offenses are artificially low because they are the most difficult to detect and prosecute. The second point, which we dispute, is that all of these studies that have been cited in this case occurred in between
I'm slow to react sometimes, but you said they're the most difficult to detect. Maybe most difficult to prosecute, but the most difficult sex crimes are easy to detect. It may be an issue of whether or not a person is willing to report.
That's a good point, Your Honor.
Whether
or not something is ultimately reported to law enforcement, but I take your point in the second that these are very difficult to prosecute in light of the fact that witnesses may not want to testify or give evidence. The second point that I would dispute their statistical claims on is that all of these studies occurred in between 1998 and 2008. So during that 10-year period, they were doing these studies all across the country. Sex offender registration and notification was in wide effect across all the 50 states. Now, they were in different forms. Everybody was using a different system. But if a study found a low recidivism rate, that could arguably be attributed to that sex offender registration does help in part. And my third point is that the state did cite to its own studies, a 2008 Michigan study where the authors concluded that the registration of released sex offenders alone is associated with a significant decrease in the frequency of crime. The reasons the authors pointed out was because that registration causes a drop in the overall frequency in attacks between an offender and a victim known to the offender. The whole point of sex offender registration is to give individuals, committing new members, parents a choice that when an offender moves into their neighborhood, the individual, parent,
but
neighbor...
But notification can be waived, can it not, for the highest tier?
That's correct. I apologize if I misspoke. It's the registration of sex offenders.
So okay, because notification, which is confusing to me, that you can bump the least egregious form up to the most and then still say, we didn't have to do community notification previously, and we'll give you that same benefit. How's that work?
Well, there's an important epilogue to that, Your Honor, is that, yes, the Senate Bill 10, when they reclassified people into Tier 3, said you must do community notification. But in the law and in the Attorney General's notice, the offender was told, you have the right to come in and ask for it to be relieved. And it's not an issue in this case because Mr. Shinaki is a Tier 2, but in the previous case, they filed, I believe it was a two-page petition with the trial court saying, please relieve me of community notification. I've done nothing since I've been left out to merit community notification. They were let out. The fact that the General Assembly is giving trial judges this discretion on the community notification point supports my argument.
Doesn't that work against the rationale for bumping the lowest form up to the highest if there's no mandatory community, if the intent, the government intent, is protection via registration and notification, and this notification is so expansive to include every county you're going to, visit, plus the cars and all that. I don't know that I can reconcile it in my mind that this is that is appropriate.
Well, the legislature may have been making gradations. They've been, when they were reclassifying people as Tier 3, they were obviously focused more about the registration, the periodic registration with the county sheriff, and left the community notification provisions up to the discretion of the individual trial judges, so that a particular case may warrant a reclassified Tier 3 offender now receiving community notification based on his behavior or conduct or facts and circumstances.
And that's part of the petition to the court, correct?
Correct.
And wouldn't you think that that would require an attorney to make a comprehensive argument to the court?
Maybe. That would be a harder case, but that's not this case because Mr. Shinaki is a Tier 2 offender. He was never been subject to community notification. So whether or not somebody gets so it's two different petitions that you can file. A petition to challenge the reclassification, which Mr. Mackey talked about, and then a separate petition to relieve the community notification requirements. A different individual may come up to this court and say, I have a civil due process right to counsel in those proceedings, and then that will be that may be a harder case.
You'll be back.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, before you sit down, the chief always tries to keep us on task, and he asked
unsuccessfully.
He asked a question.
And he tries to keep us on time, just Viper.
He asked a question.
I'm happy to stand up here all day.
Unsuccessfully, of course.
I'm not sure you ever finished your answer about if we determined it to be civil and applying the appropriate test, did you complete your answer on how the state views this in terms of your position that there should be no right to counsel as we apply the appropriate test laid out in prior cases?
That was a few minutes ago. I don't remember whether or not I completed my answer.
But all right, that's good enough.
I took you off another statistical track. So.
I will give it, try to be as brief as possible and give it again. Under the existing case law for the due process clause, to get in the door, the individual must show a potential deprivation of liberty in the proceeding or a potential termination of a fundamental constitutional right. Under the federal case law and this court's case law, Mr. Shinaki does not fit in either of those two categories because under no circumstances can the trial court in this reclassification challenge, order his confinement, like a civil commitment hearing or a juvenile delinquency proceeding. Nor, and after State v. Williams, we know that reclassification hearings or sex offender registration does not implicate a fundamental constitutional right that has been recognized by the United States Supreme Court, the right to privacy, the right to procreate, the right to free speech. Absent a showing under those two case laws, there's no civil due process right to counsel. And so,
thank you.
Unless there are any more questions, I ask that you affirm, and I'll be happy to sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Leroy. You're off for the day now.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take a brief recess.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we... What are you doing standing up?
And I have a question.
Mr. Mackey, we've taken Mr. Lieberman well over his time, so start with 2 minutes.
Okay.
I have a question. Are you aware of any case law that has held that getting government funding is a sufficient government interest to pass a law?
I am not, Your Honor.
Because everything I've read or heard and then everything I've seen in the briefs is the only reason we passed the Adam Walsh Act was because of the threat of cutoff of federal funding.
And the threat was generally insignificant.
Because they never appropriated the money in the first place.
There was a bonus amount of money, and if the state enacted it early, it would have gotten a 10% additional bonus to the sex offender management grants, which, as you point out, have never been appropriated.
They can still withhold the funds, certainly, can't they?
I'm sorry.
They can still withhold the part of it's withholding funds.
And that's the second part is withholding from the Byrne Criminal
Justice
Grant. We don't
know whether they're going to do that or not, I think. But
that was only 10% to be withheld was the maximum. And that amount could have been waived if the state worked with the U.S. Attorney General's office to come into compliance. Again, there are several states that are attempting to come into compliance. None of them have moved from a risk-based classification scheme to an offense-based classification scheme.
And why is that? They have just not done anything, or there aren't any?
Most of those states were offense-based to begin with. Ohio chose a different path with our House Bill 180. The other thing to note about this is that there is a out in the federal law. There's a funding out. If the statute or any provision of the statute violates the state constitution and that causes us to come out of substantial compliance, that's a funding out, and that funding cut, that 10% funding cut to the Byrne Criminal Justice Grants, would not be assessed. Finally, there's one other thing to note, and I think this is crucial. The federal law, and I know I'm getting a little far afield, but the federal law was not by its own terms retroactive. There's a provision in the federal law that delegated to the U.S. Attorney General the determination of how to apply the statute retroactively. It was not by its own terms retroactive, and the former administration in the Smart Office made a determination that it had to apply retroactively from day one. That may be subject to change. Those guidelines, those administrative regulations may be subject to change at some future date. There are so many states right now that are challenging Adam Walsh. There are many states that are refusing to adopt Adam Walsh just because the one-size-fits-all approach that appears to be the uniformity, which is a laudable goal, the one-size-fits-all approach tends to leave individuals behind. And the state of Ohio... I'm sorry, Justice Lanzer, can you look at...
I was going to ask if you mentioned the states, was Indiana looking at their version of the Adam Walsh or something that was previous?
They were looking at their previous law. Unfortunately, again, we're so far out front. We just, the state of Ohio just got its letter from the Smart Office, from the U.S. Attorney General's office, saying we were in substantial compliance. We had originally been found not to be in compliance.
To your knowledge, were there any other states other than Indiana that have looked at this scheme and said, you know, this is not a civil remedial scheme, but
there's a federal district court in Nevada that has held it to be unconstitutional in violation of the ex post facto clause. I believe that case is on appeal.
Let me take you back to the due process issue in this case. As you know, Mr. Lieberman says that the right to counsel depends upon threat to one's liberty, loss of liberty, or fundamental right. What's your response to that?
I think Mr. Lieberman's incorrect. The relevant United States Supreme Court case law suggests that if there is not a restraint on physical liberty at issue, there is a presumption against appointed counsel. This is Lassiter versus Department of Social Services. That presumption can be overcome using the Matthews versus Eldridge test. We assert that the Kennedy factors, which analyze this, which this court would use to analyze this statute to determine whether it is criminal or civil, even if this court were to determine that it is a civil statute, it is so close to the line. Using that analysis and then importing it into the Matthews test, this court would undoubtedly find that a right to counsel is needed. And we would assert that the three-prong Matthews test, that the interest, the private interest at issue are substantial. The state has failed in its brief to identify any public interest served by this today. They've talked about state uniformity, which is fine, but I don't know that how that necessarily serves the individual citizens of the states of Ohio. And the third prong is the risk of erroneous deprivation, which we've heard about the erroneous deprivation in Cuyahoga County, which we only know about because the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office took it upon itself to represent people at reclassification challenge hearings. They represented 460 people. My understanding is there's about 1,500 petitions that were filed in Cuyahoga County total, and they found at least, what was the number, 27? Erroneous classifications. There are undoubtedly more. And most of the counties in this state don't provide appointed counsel. And as well this court knows, most of the counties in this state do not have public defender's offices. So the risk of erroneous deprivation under the Matthews test is severe as well. I don't want to take up any more of this court's time. We would ask you to find that there's a right to counsel regardless of whether you determine the statute is civil or criminal.
Thank you, Mr. Mackey. Questions. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.